This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of July 17th, 2022. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 247. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And the big deal feature. Ripudaman Singh Malik, one of the two people accused of masterminding the biggest airborne terrorist attack before 9/11, is shot dead in Surrey, BC. Joining me to talk about the shocking July 14th killing of the 75-year-old is Salim Jiwa, the investigative reporter who covered the aftermath of Air India Flight 182 for the province newspaper. But first, the Is It Just Me commentary. Is it just me, or did you catch last week's two headlines about the sorry state of healthcare in British Columbia? Hospital emergency rooms are jammed, paramedics are struggling to keep up with the calls, and nearly a million people don't have a family doctor to call their own. On July 15th, Dr. Brian Day lost his second bid to offer medical services for a profit when the BC Court of Appeal sided with the principle of universal health care in Canada. But the government did not escape criticism. The judges called the healthcare system, quote, intentionally underdesigned in order to achieve fiscal sustainability, end quote. They also said, quote, if there is to be improvement in the delivery of timely care in the public system, the pressure of voter dissatisfaction with the current system and the sheer number of those who cannot obtain timely care will be catalysts for change, end quote. The appeal verdict came 3 days after Premier John Horgan hosted the annual summertime summit for Canada's premiers in Victoria. The premiers didn't get the funding increase they demanded from the federal government. It was a failure of biblical proportions for Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's favorite premier. At the last summit for the soon-to-retire Horgan, Horgan felt betrayed.
24 months ago, we were collaborating in an unprecedented way. What Ontario required, the rest of the country was working to make sure that we could deliver. I know that Jason in Alberta had a backlog of personal protective equipment that we were able to distribute across a surplus of materials that he welcomed the rest of us to access. Premier Fury and his spouse traveled to Ottawa as physicians to help out. I mean, there was unprecedented collaboration, and the federal government was right there, and we applauded that engagement. It was an unprecedented time for all Canadians, but it was also an unprecedented time in our federation. And now, 8 months later, we're exchanging notes through the media. Where'd the love go? You know, I mean, everything was so fine, and then it wasn't. I mean, it's vexing that we could have made so much progress together, and now when we all recognize that the cracks in our precious healthcare system are there for all to see, most importantly, our citizens who want services, when we turn to our partners, our allies, and say, hey, let's get together and figure this out, they go, no, you got enough, or you're going to waste it, or maybe we can't talk to you right now, there's something else going on. What could be more important for the intergovernmental relations minister than to relate with the other governments of Canada? Is there anything else on his docket beyond the 13 of us? I wouldn't think so, but here we are.
Maybe instead of pointing the finger at the feds, Horgan needs to examine where the NDP government went wrong before and during the pandemic. We need a judicial public inquiry. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Just before 9:30 a.m. on July 14th, in the Newton district of Surrey, BC, somebody in a white Honda CR-V shot Ripudaman Singh Malik to death. The 75-year-old died at the scene, sending shocks through the Indo-Canadian community in British Columbia, especially those that remember the horrific June 23, 1985 bombing of an Air India 747 off the coast of Ireland. all 329 people aboard died in the worst airborne terrorist incident before 9/11. Malik and Ajib Singh Bagri were tried and acquitted in 2005 of planning the attack. The Crown failed to prove their guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. My guest is investigative reporter Salim Jiwa, who covered the Air India aftermath for the Province newspaper. He also wrote two books, The Death of Air India Flight 182 and Margin of Terror, a reporter's 20-year odyssey covering the tragedies of the Air India bombing. Businessman Ripudaman Singh Malik had many friends. He also had many enemies.
What does the killing of Malik mean for the broader diaspora in Surrey and elsewhere in Canada? And what does it mean, especially for the victims' families?
I think the victim families are going to likely see this as karma. They firmly believed that because of media coverage, because of what had happened, books and other things, they completely believed that he was somebody who got away with it. On the other hand, my approach has been and based on the knowledge of the witness, that was a key witness, a woman in his trial, who was allegedly his girlfriend, who hugged him but never kissed him, who I had great interactions with. Well, she was always fishing for information. Well, you know, the trial it was an acquittal, not guilty. And many people wondered why. But the credibility of the witness just wasn't there, and the justice, Josephson, was right in dismissing that case against at least Malik. Bagri's case also hinged on a woman's testimony. She was a friend of his. On the other hand, Riyat was nailed on buying parts and physical evidence against him. There was no physical evidence against Malik, no physical evidence against Bagri. There was physical evidence against Riyat, the bomb maker. And Riyat now is out on parole and leading a quiet life. Bagri has disappeared. But Malik never really disappeared from the scene. He continued to operate within the community with his finances, his financial abilities. A controversial figure, like you say, the Khalsa school system started because of him. I remember the time when I went to his first Khalsa school on Fraser Street or Main Street, somewhere here, and we sat together and listened to some of the kids reciting religious hymns and stuff. And it was basically a great moment of pride for him that the kids could do that. So he was very much into religion. I met him numerous times over the course of the militancy from 1981 to 1992, 1993. And a soft-spoken man, very soft-spoken man. I never got angry and laughed easily. So he was quite a character. And in Surrey and elsewhere, there will be mixed feelings amongst people depending on whether they even believe that Sikh militants did the Air India bombing, whether they even believe that Malik was involved or not involved. So we're going to see a mix of reaction. If you look at the Facebook page where the Education Society has posted something about his death, you see a lot of people who have commented. There is grief. And in certain areas, such as the victims of the Air India bombing and the families, there will be that sense, as I said, of karma. Very, very active figure in the community. And his letter to the Prime Minister of India was controversial and public. And that in that letter, he basically thanked the Hindu nationalist Prime Minister of India, Mr. Modi, for addressing some of the concerns of victims of rioting and rapes and other things that happened in India in the wake of the assassination of Mrs. Gandhi, who had ordered the assault on the Golden Temple. So we have a man writing a letter which to more militant factions, or more those people who are at least emotionally still balanced on the idea of Khalistan, an independent Sikh republic. They still want it emotionally, they do. They might not be as active physically, but for those kinds of guys, it would appear to them to be Malik turning his back on them. And he basically offered to work with the government of India on correcting the friction that exists in Surrey and in large diaspora areas. So that's Malik for you.
Yeah, there still is a lot of friction in the Indo-Canadian community, a lot of factions still. This leads all the way back to the 1980s when this really did come to a head with the 1984 invasion of the Golden Temple, the holiest place in the Sikh faith in Amritsar, India. And it had ripple effects all the way around the world, even before this heinous terrorist incident happened. What next for the community? What next for those who are various factions of religion, whether it's the Orthodox or just the others who are more westernized, if you can call it that? What next for this community?
I think modernist and Orthodox is the keywords here in terms of describing these people. There are those who still hold out the hope for a Khalistan, which is something that they have aspired to for a long, long time, from the time of partition of India and Pakistan into a Muslim nation and a Sikh nation. The Sikhs got a chance, but they lost it, and they stayed within India. So there are two factions in the context of people whose minds are still filled with the idea of Khalistan, and those who are comfortable being in India and being identified as Indians. I don't think the dynamics of that situation will change, but I'm hoping that there is not, again, kind of a tribal warfare of the type we saw with the tables and chairs issues at the temples, where the modernists wanted tables and chairs. The Orthodox faction said, we sit on the floor when we are in the house of God, because we want to be lower than God. Now, I think you'll still be lower than God, even if you're sitting on a chair. But this was the friction that resulted in a lot of violence within communities back when, 10, 15 years ago. So I'm hoping that calm prevails, that people will see this as an isolated event and not, we don't see retaliation and revenge and vigilantes out there. And that's my hope, Bob.
Definitely, there's been a lot of soul searching within the South Asian community, especially in Surrey, about what this means to the faith, to the culture, to the community. But this awful incident in 1985, and then the failure in court to get the convictions for the prosecution, led to the Air India inquiry under Prime Minister Stephen Harper, announced in 2006. It was the findings published in June 2010. In a nutshell, the key finding was it blamed a, quote, cascading series of errors, end quote, by government, by the RCMP, by CSIS. So our lawmakers, the bureaucrats, our police, our intelligence service. Harper eventually apologized to the victims' families. Do you think that our governments have learned enough from this incident to prevent anything like this from happening again, and to also encourage peace and dialogue within communities, not just the South Asian community, but any community which is suffering a crisis of identity or radicalism?
Yes, I realize that the errors were occurring right from the very beginning. Remember, most of these people who died on the Air India plane were Canadian citizens, regardless of the ethnicity. And the Prime Minister of Canada, Mr. Mulroney, sent his condolences to the government of India. And these kinds of errors, the RCMP, who I knew very well, who I met with often, we had the difficulty adapting to the cultural, mindset, where they thought they could operate just as they routinely do within the community from which most of them come from. But they found that this was a culture which concealed also a culture of shame rather than guilt. And they found it difficult. Errors were made right from the very beginning of the investigation. RCMP made errors, CSIS made errors. The government of Canada refused to call this incident official documents until the publication of my book 6 months after the incident. They refused to acknowledge that this was a terrorist bombing. And during a coroner's inquiry in Ireland, the point blank tried to stop the coroner from ruling that it was a terrorist bombing. But when my book came out, they stopped calling it the Air India incident or accident and started calling it what it was, because we knew what the RCMP had. The RCMP had evidence of a bomb. And yet the government was hell-bent on, not having this huge spot of shame on us as Canadians, having allowed the worst terrorist event of its kind to have occurred from our soil.
Salim Jiwa's previous appearances on the Breaker.News podcast have featured his shrewd analysis of the BC government's response to the coronavirus pandemic. BC is now in a seventh wave, and there is no end in sight.
And the World Health Organization came out to remind us, this isn't over yet. This isn't over yet by a long shot. Talk about where we are now and where we need to be and what we need to do.
Look, we seem to be in a mode where public health has managed to convince this government of the seasonality of COVID, that is seasonal, that it will occur during the respiratory season, meaning when the flu starts, COVID will start again. But we have evidence from the Southern Hemisphere, the Northern Hemisphere, that there is really no seasonal issue here, that COVID prevails regardless of it's hot or it is cold or whatever season it is. We're in the middle of summer and we have a hike in BA5. It has gone from 40% of our tested cases in 1 week to 56%. And that's only the few people that we're testing. We're testing only some very limited number of people. It's not widespread testing. So you can imagine that those numbers are jumping every week. And I wouldn't be one bit surprised if we reach 100% in the next 2 weeks. BA5 is an extremely dangerous virus. It is the most, it spreads much faster than previous versions. It evades a vaccination. It attacks people who had four shots. It attacks people who had previous Omicron infections. Now, the government seems to have been geared up for fall. And we will be warning them about the rising numbers that we are seeing. And I posted once recently that the sixth and seventh wave would merge. And we are in the seventh wave without the government acknowledging it. We have 400 and some people in hospital now. 2 weeks ago, we had 230 people. We haven't seen deaths rising, but they will eventually, because as soon as people enter hospitals, there's a lag time between entry into hospital and deaths being reported. We need a fourth shot, which the government should make available to everyone. And when the Omicron-specific vaccine comes out in the fall, in September, we should adhere to the original timeline offered by Pfizer and Moderna of 8 weeks between shots. It can be done by adjusting just the timing, which is arbitrary anyway. But I'm afraid the government isn't paying attention. We need masking very soon. LA has said they will be going to masking within no time. And now, if LA is willing to do it on the basis of 8,000 cases per day, and the threshold of 10 people in hospital per 100,000 people, it will be reached within 3 or 4 days, and you'll see LA issuing a masking order for indoors places. And you saw Dr. Tam's warning today of escalating cases, but our government seems to be inactive. We haven't heard from anybody in public health. It seems to me that the hands-off attitude is failing us, as they have done from the very beginning of this pandemic. And I don't think it'll get any better for us.
That was my guest, Salim Jiwa, investigative reporter, formerly with the Province newspaper and author of two books about the 1985 Air India terrorist bombing. Podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taiwan news, vaccine requirements put damper on Taiwan's Sun Moon Lake swimming event. Vaccination and rapid testing requirements for participation in this year's Sun Moon Lake International Swimming Carnival, for which registration began 10 days ago, have prevented the event from quickly reaching participation capacity, which rarely happens in the event's 40 years of history. The Cross Lake Swimming event, which was canceled last year due to the pandemic, will be held on September the 4th. There will be a limit of 20,000 participants. In Kyoto news, Japanese firms more loath to invest in China amid zero COVID policy. China's tough restrictions on people's movements, which have disrupted domestic supply chains for more than 2 years, have prevented Japanese firms from mapping out their business strategies. In May, the American Chamber of Commerce in China said 26% of its member firms had already cut investment in the Asian nation, while a similar EU organization said 23% of its members had considered withdrawing from the Chinese market. Many Japanese enterprises have also been eager to reduce their staff in China, given that the country's strict quarantine requirements. In the Hong Kong Free Press, disheveled Hong Kong activist who was shot by police spent 2 years hiding in a safe house in a bid to flee. Police said four were detained as they tried to leave Hong Kong. Local media reports said they planned to leave by speedboat for Taiwan. The four appeared in court on Thursday after hiding out for nearly 2 years and moving between safe houses concealed in cardboard cartons, police said. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, an Oregon couple and their goat, Frankie, are featured in new Discovery Plus series, The Bond. The episode featuring Chad and Kate Battles follows the couple as they, and Frankie, set out from their Grants Pass home for a trip around the West in their Airstream. It's a journey that takes them through gorgeous scenery in Idaho, Wyoming, and Montana, and concludes with an emotional stop on the southern coast of Oregon. In Cairo 7, Seattle Council sends both ranked choice and approval voting to November ballot. In November, a single yes or no question will be placed on the ballot, asking voters if either initiative should be approved. If voters select yes, they will then select which of the two measures they prefer. If approved, Initiative 134 would go into effect no later than 2025. Under a proposal, ranked choice voting would be implemented in 2027. Approval voting would let voters support as many candidates for a given elected position as they would like. The two candidates who receive the greatest number of votes advance to the general election. In Czech news, low tides hit Vancouver Island with more expected through the week. Vancouver Island experienced a low tide level event, bringing levels lower than expected with a peak of 0.02 meters on Wednesday. A combination of atmospheric pressure, the summer solstice, and the alignment of the moon are the cause of this. The record low tide in Victoria of 0.04 meters was back in 1957. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Don't matter what color you are, cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Pat John, who played Jesse on The Beachcombers. He was a trailblazing Indigenous actor on the iconic Canadian TV show that ran on CBC from 1972 to 1990. John died last week at age 69. Somewhere we can hope he'll be hauling logs and entertaining people, along with Bruno Gerussi, who played Nicodonidas, and Robert Clothier, also known as Relic. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
Domi bracia, cosas corona.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of July 17th, 2022. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 17th of July in 1955, Disneyland opened in Anaheim, California? And on the 17th of July in 1976, the Olympics opened in Montreal. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit TheBreaker.News on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. That's PATREON.com/TheBreakerNews. Until next week.